Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, I have a very special guest. Dr. Kerry Journey is joining us from, where do you live, Kerry?
I live in the San Francisco Bay Area right now.
A very affordable, low cost of living location.
Yeah, absolutely.
We are going to talk about mental health challenges today. We talked about this a few weeks back, and I think it's so important. It's so critical to have these conversations. I wanted to have somebody I think that knows a lot more about this than I do and has really created and really fostered this amazing community of veterinarians called the Not One More Vet group. Kerry, is that right?
That's right. We affectionately call it NOMV because Not One More Vet is a bit of a mouthful. But right now we have, just over 25,000 veterinary professionals in our support groups. So we support not just veterinarians, but also support staff and vet students. But our biggest group is our veterinarian group.
I'm having this podcast for a couple reasons. One is I would love to see something like this pop up in other professions because we know that professionals, across the board suffer from mental health challenges, especially because of the high cost of education and the anxieties and problems that people are facing nowadays. And so I think that if you're a veterinarian, listen to this because you're going to get an enormous amount out of it. And if you're not a veterinarian, listen to this because you're going to hear things, I think, that are going to be familiar to a lot of people. And then also you might be inspired by what Kerry and her cohorts and colleagues have done for the veterinary community. And maybe you could do that or you could influence that happening for your community. So before we get too far into it, Kerry, if you could just kind of tell us a little bit more about what NOMV, Not One More Vet, how it started, what it is, for the people who have no idea what we're talking about right now.
Absolutely. So NOMV started very innocently, actually. Our founder, I'm not actually the founder, Nicole MacArthur, Dr. Nicole MacArthur is our founder. And she was just texting with a few friends. We had just lost a very prominent veterinarian, Dr. Sophia Yin. She died by suicide. And she was an amazingly positive force in the veterinary community. She pioneered all of these fear-free handling techniques and things. You know, she was always smiling. She was always happy. She was always helping people. She was kind of who every veterinarian wanted to be. So when she died by suicide, it was a pretty big blow to our community. And there were some things in the paper. She was local. She was at the university in California, University of Davis area. And so one of Nicole's non-veterinarian friends reached out to her and was like, I'm reading all this stuff in the paper about compassion fatigue and burnout and suicide in veterinary medicine. And I just want to check on you two as two veterinarians in the text. Like, how are you doing? Are you okay? And Nicole and this other veterinarian just started to talk about how the job is really not just playing with doggies and kitties all day. Right? There are some very difficult, hard parts of the job that the general public never sees. And Nicole, who had struggled a good deal with burnout and mental health issues throughout her career, she's a second generation veterinarian married to a veterinarian. So you can imagine her whole life is veterinary medicine. She said that that conversation was the first time that she didn't feel alone. And she didn't feel like she was the worst vet. She didn't feel like she was the only one that couldn't handle this. It really pointed out to her that a lot of us in this profession struggle with very similar things. So she just went on Facebook and started a Facebook group, right? Like she just wanted to talk to some of her classmates from vet school and her friends about stuff. And they added their friends and they added their friends. And so now we're, to that crazy number of 25,000 veterinary professionals. And we have global membership. We have members in every continent there is. So it's been amazing. It's been really inspiring.
Now, you said a word, compassion fatigue. That is a really interesting word, and I imagine it's a word that probably applies to a lot of healthcare professionals. What is compassion fatigue, and what's an example of compassion fatigue?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of words that get thrown around. Burnout, compassion fatigue, moral distress. Basically, we're trying to define this thing that we see that happens in professional groups, where you enter into this profession after usually a tremendous and terrifying amount of schooling with this drive and this need to help people, and it's particularly in healthcare fields, we're driven by altruism and the need to help others. And then the day-to-day realities, the logistical realities, all of those things start to just wear on you. And there's this kind of structure that you go through where you just like try to work harder, because anyone who's gotten to this stage in their career is a good hard worker. And you try to work harder through it, and then you just kind of find this space where you can't fix it. And then you get into this very desperate state where you're exhausted. You can no longer feel or give the amount that you used to give. And it's really disheartening. I mean, literally no one becomes a veterinarian for the money because the money is terrible. And as I'm sure we'll discuss, but we come because we want to help. We come because we have this drive to help. And then we really get tortured by that helping, unless we're taking excellent care of ourselves and having excellent boundaries. So compassion fatigue and all of these other phrases that float around this issue really are trying to define the little pieces, parts of what's happening there.
Tell me if I'm understanding this wrong. Is an example of compassion fatigue, you don't have it in you to feel like to give a patient like the kind of empathy that you want to give them, or
the very worst level of it? You know, you are at the place where you are beyond coping. I mean, we're way past into exhaustion, where we've grown very cynical, we've grown very angry, we're detached from family and friends, we're really starting to like pull back into this, like trying to protect ourselves from this wave that keeps coming at us. When you first get out, you know, any case that walks through the door, you are happy to help them immediately. That puppy who comes in at 5 p.m. when you're supposed to close at 5:15, you're happy to stay late, you're happy to be there, you're just happy to help. But when you have built a career on always missing dinner with your family, never getting home on time, always having 15-hour days, like you can begin to see how now that puppy comes through the door at 5:15 and you're like, I can't do this. I don't care how sick it is. And it's really hard. And it's really, I think there's so much internal struggle there because there's still that little kernel of you, that little 18-year-old who applied to vet school, like they're still in there and they're so sad that you're so tired and that you can't enjoy that part of your job that drew you to the field. So it's a real problem. And it's something where the solutions are not easy.
What is another term you used was moral something. What was that?
Moral distress. So moral distress is something, it's a very common phenomenon in veterinary medicine. It's being prevented from doing what you feel is right by logistics or circumstances or whatever. And the most common example of this in veterinary medicine is we are a healthcare provider, clearly, but we are also a cash-based service. So much like many dentists are, although dental insurance is now much more popular than pet insurance, when you come to the vet, we as doctors present with you a treatment plan and you have to approve a financial estimate and pay us that money for that service when the service is due. That means a lot of times the medicine that I spent more than a decade learning is not possible. And in fact, there's a study, Dr. Barry Kipperman did a study where he's found that 52% of veterinarians face this scenario every single day. And if anything, I think that number is too low. Like, I don't know a veterinarian who doesn't face that scenario every single day. And so we constantly are having to not practice the medicine we want to practice, not do the things that we think these patients need because we're prevented by owner finances. And that's not blaming the owners. Your budget is your budget, but that's the kind of push-pull that really, you can see how that wears on you. You know, I just want to help this dog. This owner wants me to help this dog. Everybody wants the same thing, but this logistical circumstance is preventing us from doing it, which just makes everybody angry and frustrated. And it's particularly infuriating for that person that loves that pet. And it's exhausting to me who has to deal with it day in and out. It's really a difficult thing. And it's one of, I think, when we really start to talk about what bothers us as veterinarians, that one in particular is one that comes up again and again and again.
One example, I guess, is I had a client who told me she cried over this young puppy that this guy accidentally ran over the dog's leg and broke the leg, and she could fix it, but it was going to be like a few hundred bucks. And this guy made, you know, $7 an hour and just didn't have that kind of money. And so said, sorry, you have to euthanize. I can't afford that.
Yeah.
I mean, she was just heartbroken over that. I think that was one of her first experiences, maybe, which is why it stuck with her so much.
They all get us, right? And, you know, like there are all sorts of circumstances within there that, you know, make it worse or harder for a million reasons. I could drag up a million from my career, but, you know, sometimes it's someone's last remaining memory of their spouse. You know, it's an older gentleman. This is his wife's dog. His wife's passed away. He's on a limited income. These are real life scenarios that veterinarians face every day. And remember, we didn't go into this field to make money. We went in to help. But the reality of I need to pay my staff, I need to pay my student loans, I have to keep the lights on in the clinic,
right,
is also reality. And you can't do it for free. And so it just feels terrible. And I honestly think it's led to this kind of bad scenario where I can't think of another profession that hates money more than veterinarians. Like, we don't like to talk about it. We don't like to think about it. We just don't want to deal with it because it's the thing in our career that tortures us so much.
So we'll come back to that. But, you know, before we press the record, you told me you'd done some surveys.
I did.
Before I ask about that, I'll just say the results of ours found that veterinarians had the highest incidence of mental health challenges of any profession with student loans and just a combination of everything, really.
Yeah.
We found 1 in 10 veterinarians had considered suicide because of their student loan debt. I think on looking on your website, there was something that said 1 in 6 had considered it, you know, in general for any reason. Maybe you can share some of the surveys that you've done and maybe some of the results.
Sure, absolutely. So yeah, I saw your survey and I thought it was a really interesting number. Yeah, depending on the study you read, veterinarians, and I don't like to be competitive. This is not something that I want my profession to win, but we often have either the highest suicide rate or rate of what's called serious psychological distress. Clearly, we have a problem in our profession. And so that 1 in 6 number is one that we talk about a lot. It kind of just brings it home on how common veterinarians are not only struggling, but struggling to an extreme degree. So I asked in Not One More Vet this morning in our veterinarian support group, I asked what everyone's current loan balance was, and I broke it down in 50K increments, and I won't bore you with every single number, but it was really interesting, the spread. In general, both in 2016 and 2019, the AVMA said that average student debt coming out of school is about 150K. I think it was 143 in 2016. It went up a little bit, but the average has kind of stayed there. But what we're seeing is a trend towards a population of veterinarians having tremendously high debt. And we found that in our studies. In the group of people who had less than $100,000 in debt, that was about 40% of our population. Between 100 and 200K, which is kind of that average group, was a quarter. Above 200K was 37%. So if you map those out, you start to see like we really either have people that have very little to no student debt. I mean, not that $100,000 is nothing, but in a manageable amount of student debt or no student debt, to what really becomes, if you start to do the math on veterinary salaries, an unmanageable amount of debt. So above 200K, you're really struggling. Then we asked, how important is your student debt in making major life decisions? Like, how much do you think about your student debt when you are picking where you're going to live? What are you going to do? What job are you going to take? And that was really telling. So by far and away, it is very important in these decisions was the most common category. So we had, it is the most important thing. It is a very important thing. I consider it. It's a minor thing or it doesn't matter at all. So those were our categories. And very important was 72% of our responders. So by far and away, student loans weigh on a veterinarian's mind a tremendous amount when making important decisions. So it's very important to us. Like this clearly affects us. And then I asked, how much does your student debt negatively affect your well-being? And I said, an extreme amount, a great deal, neutral, not much, or not at all. And it affects it a great deal, a good deal, with 61% of responders. That's really a tremendous amount. That's the second to highest category. So the next most common response was not much. So once again, we're seeing people are like, yeah, it doesn't really bother me at all. Or like, no, this is super important to me. And so,
wow.
Yeah, it was just, it was an interesting kind of snapshot. And, you know, in the comments of that survey, people kind of dug into it a little more. Like one veterinarian said that her student loans make her feel trapped, that she can't leave a job because she's trapped by these loans. One person said they had no idea how much mental load the loans had on them until she paid them off. And she suddenly felt this freedom that she didn't even know. She didn't know she'd been holding on to something that tight. I think there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, a lot of studies have actually, studies are starting to show that this is a big part of what's happening. It's not everything, but it is a big part of it.
Yeah. One thing, kind of the premise of what we do is that like student loan debt can be a tax. So like if Biden won the election, he's talking about repealing the student loan tax basically on forgiven student loans, right? And so then if it was just a straight percentage of your income, then everybody would realize like student loans are just a percentage of your income. So then it wouldn't so much matter if you had $600,000 from going to, you know, the most expensive like Royal School in Edinburgh, right? Like the overseas one or one of the super cheap in-state ones. You know, either way, you would be able to afford that because it's a percentage of your income. I think where vets get kind of like freaked out is forgiveness going to go away. And like there's this tax bomb and like, and they don't understand that you can translate that into a percentage of their income going into index funds every month. But the world was different back when you went to vet school. Like what was it like back when you went to vet school with the financing?
I like to think that I'm still young, but I'm not, is the reality. And so I graduated vet school in 2005. Dinosaurs roamed the earth. And vet school cost about between $6,000 and $10,000 a semester. So, and I say 6 to 10 because it actually went up while I was in vet school. Like I signed on the dotted line, was halfway through my education, and it went up pretty dramatically, actually, which happens to a lot of students, which is, if you think about it, they have so much sunk cost that like, it's not like they can change their mind.
You have no choice. Yeah. You're captive.
Yeah, exactly. You're in. And I looked up my alma mater today, and it was about $37,000 a semester right now to go to the University of Georgia. And the University of Georgia is actually relatively inexpensive compared to some other institutions. There's a institution here in California that's $55,000 a semester. And I mean, wow, that really starts to add up, especially when you're looking at starting salaries at $60,000 and average salaries of your entire career being in like 90. Very quickly, we're reaching debt to income ratios that are just not sustainable.
A couple of thoughts on that stat that you gave me. The one issue is you've got, you know, like the two Americas idea, right? Like there's the rich America, the poor America. You're kind of in like two veterinary med Americas, right? Like you have the rich, really kind of wealthy group of students that's literally like parents are like, yep, got it, paying for it, or we're giving you all but living expenses, right? Like we'll pay for the tuition. You can take out some loans for living expenses. And then you have the group that borrows the full amount. And so the problem is those people that borrowed like the 20K a year of living expenses or the 10K, whatever, they get included in that average. So the average looks like it's not that big of a deal. But if you look at the difference between the amount of people that have the actual cost that they financed in full, that's exploding. And also like the vet schools also do such a bad job disclosing this, probably for, you know, maybe, I don't know, intentional reasons perhaps, but possibly. I remember I got this angry commenter on my blog from a vet school. I won't mention which one. I estimated that the cost of it, of the attending this particular university in this blog post was going to be around $300,000. And he said, how dare you throw around, you know, such outrageously high numbers. I spoke to a student just the other day who was graduating that only has $120,000. And so I looked at the cost of attendance on their site, and I said, so did you provide the wealthy parents, or did they come with those prepackaged, you know?
Yeah. You know, kind of the fantasy of you're going to work through school to afford your, that is not a reality in professional school. Your full-time job is school. And so you, I mean, and I was a gunner with a capital G. I had every job, side hustle, et cetera, I could during vet school. But the only reason I got out relatively unscathed is, frankly, I had a husband who was working. You know, I had that benefactor that could help me weather it. And that allowed me to, you know, even continue my education. And where we're particularly feeling the pain is like some sectors of veterinary medicine are not getting enough students that want to go into those sectors and people that want to stay in those sectors. So things like food animal medicine, practices that are like in really rural environments, you can't make enough money in those environments and pay off $200,000 in loans. You just, that math does not work. That population of clients cannot afford to pay the rates that you need to make enough money to pay your loans. And so it's just this, it's kind of impending disaster that we have in our field.
Some of the schools, like in the dental world, for example, I think USC is one that has been very transparent with students that you will not be able to pay this debt off. Some of the schools just straight up continue just saying the cliches for the past 20 years that aren't true anymore. Like, oh, you're going to pay this off in no time. Our average repayment rate is like 7 years. But some of these schools that are super expensive have, I mean, the reason they're raising the prices is because they can, because you can charge a percentage of income. And I think the schools are going to start moving towards that over time. Like if they do face an enrollment crisis, they're going to start trying to get better with that message of, well, actually, you can just pay a percentage of your income. So it doesn't matter if you have $5 million in student loans. I mean, that's what they're going to say. It's a bad world, but that's where I think that you're heading if you don't cap the amount of student loans that can be borrowed.
Yeah, no, I'm very grateful for people like you who understand this way better. It's just, it's not an area, it's an area of particular lack of knowledge in the veterinary community. Because once again, we have that moral distress thing that tortures us all the time. Like, money is not our friend. I get yelled about money all day long. I don't want to think about money. I go home and my bills are too big. Like, I don't want to deal with any of it. And so a lot of veterinarians kind of like just put their hands over their eyes and over their ears and like, I'm not going to pay attention to this. And then those are the vets that have that balloon payment that hits them at the end and they're not ready for it.
What stress differences do you see between, like, say, that veterinarian in their 40s, 50s versus a veterinarian in their 20s, 30s? Like, what are some of those, you know, obviously student loans, but I'm just curious if you're seeing a huge difference in, like, the stress levels.
We're actually starting to see in the literature a pretty decided split. And it's not quite, I would say that 30s and 40s are grouped together more. And I'm doing that because I'm in my 40s, of course. But, you know, our vets over 50 and our vets under 50, we definitely see different groups of people with different stress levels. So the younger you are, unfortunately, the higher rates of decreased well-being and what's called serious psychologic distress, which is like a mental health problem where you actually need mental health care to get through it. It's not just like you need a vacation, like you need a vacation and a therapist. Those rates are much higher in our younger population of vets. And we're still unwrapping like what pieces are parts of that. And student debt is a big one of them. I mean, like I said, I graduated in 2005 and my debt was, you know, it was something, but it was also within a manageable amount for my career path. Like it was something that even if I had not had a husband and I had taken the full amount, like I could have paid that off in my career path and not had, you know, it would have affected me, but not greatly. These guys that are coming out now with these tremendous debt loads, it's really hard. You know, it's actually changed how I, as an older vet, talk to young people who want to become a veterinarian. You know, we don't talk about how hard the job is, you know, on a day-to-day basis anymore as the first item. My first item with it is, how are you going to pay for school? I don't want to hear you taking out loans. Let's not do that. And let's find a better way. But it's hard. That's keeping people from the field. People that would be great. It's a rough time.
Well, it'll have to be resolved and addressed at some point. Eventually it will. Like in 100 years from now, animals will need care. Robots are not going to do it, right? You're going to need to train people to do that. So there will be something. It's a question of how much pain is there going to be along the way figuring it out, right? Let me ask this. So like back in the day, I'm really talking like vets in their like 60s, 70s here. I feel like the corporatization of vet med has really accelerated in the past 20 years. And I feel like back in the day, maybe people could not really know as much what they're doing with money and still be fairly successful opening up their own clinic and being kind of the, I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts about that? Like, you know, do younger vets have it way harder now with all the private equity money that are buying up all these vet groups?
I think there's a dichotomy there. And I think it's not just as simple as corporate medicine bad, private medicine good. I think the reality is that there is a lot of economy of scale that is available in corporate medicine, right? Things like if you can buy 400 cases of fluids a week versus 4 cases of fluids a week, you're getting a better deal. And so for sure, corporate medicine provides some benefits. And then also you get some back end structure that's really helpful. So if you're a vet who just wants to like go to your job, have good benefits, doesn't want to think about the business, doesn't require like a high level of control about what's happening in your day to day, there are really a lot of good things about corporate medicine that actually can provide a more robust business back end structure versus private medicine, where certainly many veterinarians, including myself, are control freaks and we want control. But, you know, that means that I have to figure out things like HR. I have to figure out, you know, things like business insurance and like all of these little things that I, as a private doctor, now have to do that aren't just practicing medicine. For sure, we have seen corporate medicine explode. I was talking to my husband the other day. There isn't a single multi-specialty and ER hospital. So these are the kind of next tier of vet hospitals, not the place you go for your general care, your vaccines, your like minor illnesses. This is where you go where it's like 2 a.m. and your dog got hit by a car. Like those type of practices in my area, every single one of them has been bought by a corporation in the last year, at least in my immediate area. And so it's definitely a thing. And, you know, healthcare is really expensive. It has a tremendously high overhead. So as a private hospital, I'm a neurologist. I need an MRI. The average cost of an MRI, a used MRI, not even a new MRI, like a used MRI is between $500,000 and $1 million. And that's not even installing it. So like, how am I, Carrie Journey veterinarian, who has just been practicing as hard as I can, going to save up that amount of money for that? That leap is really hard as a private individual. And that's why I think corporate medicine has really kind of taken off. It's like, they understand financing. They understand like all of these things. So it's a trade-off, right? Like, absolutely, you trade things for that kind of like, well, somebody else is going to write the check and handle it. But it also lets you be a doctor and not be any of the other stuff, which I think I do see a trend. I hate to say it's all vets because that's never the case, right? There are certainly a good deal of younger vets that I know who really want balance. We've been preaching the wellness about as hard as we can. And they're like, no, I don't want to be a practice owner. I just want to go to my job and have my job treat me well. And I want to go home at the end of my day and know I did a good job and that's it. There's a really good space where like a well-run corporate practice could be a great fit for those people. But we're in a paradigm shift right now. And so there's a lot of fighting in veterinary medicine over corporate versus non-corporate. Like corporate's evil. Like, oh, it's never that simple.
Sure. But that's great perspective. I mean, when you said that example, this 2 a.m. and my dog got hit by a car, I immediately thought when you said that all the private companies have bought all those places up, immediately just my head went to the financing of that. As a private equity or, you know, investor, which your goal is profit, you're like, when can I extract a ton of money out of somebody, right? It's when they're in high levels of distress. They are very emotionally distressed. And it's like, you have to make the decision right then or there. You can't comparison shop.
There's some push-pull there, right? Like, absolutely. I would say healthcare in America in general, it's very, very challenging to price shop when it's an emergency, right? If you're unconscious, you can't see what the cheapest ER. That's just not reality. The other reality is veterinarians are constrained by overhead and equipment costs that are equivalent to human medicine. We buy the same bag of fluids the human hospital does, and we have not even a hundredth the resources. And our clients do hit a ceiling. There is a bill that I will slide across the table and the owner will go, I cannot do that. And they will euthanize. So there is a price downward pressure from the client base. And so I would say that in general, once again, you know, veterinary medicine, not a tremendously great place for return on investment as far as an investor goes. And it is that pushback from like, you know, we buy the same antibiotics, we buy the same, you know, equipment, we buy, you know, we buy the used stuff, but like we have all of the same stuff. Medicine has come a tremendously long way. And I think of myself, I am a dog neurosurgeon. The surgery that I charge, and I will admit that this is expensive for a person paying it out of their pocket, and it is an emergency. We charge between $8,000 and $10,000 for that surgery. Your dog is paralyzed. I can make it walk 94% of the time. That's tremendous, right? Like everybody wants that. It's $8,000 to $10,000. That is a tremendous amount of money. That same surgery in human medicine costs $100,000. And so you start to see of like, it is expensive, but we are paying the same equipment costs. We have the same level of staff training. Like it's just, there's a really fine, weird line that we walk as veterinarians on trying to like help as many dogs as we can and keep the lights on.
That's really fascinating because I think that if the working class person that heard that expense understood the overhead and understood all of those things, they might not be able to pay it, but at least they wouldn't blame you. They wouldn't say the things that time after time after time just add up, right?
Unfortunately, yeah, that we hear all the time. And it really comes from a place, I know that they don't know what the overhead bills look like, right? They don't know how much MRI costs. Why would they? And so in that moment, they love their dog. And I've just told them this astronomical number that they can't afford. And they have all of those feelings about it. And it absolutely contributes to veterinary stress because we're dealing with those people, right? That's my day job. And so like, that's definitely part of how all of this financial stuff rolls back into well-being.
Do you find that like when somebody makes that decision to euthanize, like how do you like, you know, as a vet, not convey judgment or something in a situation you feel like they're making a bad decision? I mean,
I think, you know, there's a lot of difficult parts to that decision, right? Like it depends, first of all, how fixable the problem is. That is a huge long scale of how fixable problems are. Certainly every veterinarian, especially because many of us are financially struggling ourselves, understands the reality of finances. I think for particularly young dogs and particularly fixable things, you will see veterinarians start to do devil's bargain type stuff, which because they don't want to do it, right? They don't want to put down the puppy whose leg is broken that they could fix. They don't want to, you know, and I have that line for myself too. And like, as much as I try to be a business-minded veterinarian, like I also did not get into this to make money. So, and like there is a price on my soul and like that's not it. So that's where we start to see things like surrenders happen. And so surrendering is this thing that happens in veterinary medicine where the veterinarian will actually take the dog on, or somebody in the clinic will adopt the dog from the owner and then pay for their care. So you can start to see there's this background cost to being a veterinarian didn't even expect. You're not even just going to pay for your own animals in your own life. You're also going to take on other people's dogs and pay for them too. It actually gets veterinarians into a lot of trouble. It's a very common way that cyberbullying starts. We have actually a pretty tremendous problem with cyberbullying in our profession. 1 in 5 veterinarians has experienced cyberbullying in their career. You are trying so hard to save this dog's life, so hard that you take the dog and pay for it yourself and do all of this. And the owner goes home and they have all sorts of complicated feelings about not being able to afford their dog's care. And now the dog's not theirs anymore. And there's all this legal paperwork they had to sign. And they get on Facebook and the narrative turns into those people stole my dog. And it explodes. And I've seen it too many times. I've seen it so many times. And that's a hard moment, right? Like as a veterinarian who just basically didn't make any money this week because you're paying for someone else's dog. Now on Facebook, there's 10,000 angry people calling your clinic with death threats because you tried to help a dog. And so that's another like really concerning thing that certainly wasn't a problem 20 years ago, right? Like Facebook wasn't a thing. So
there's good and bad, like anything. So cyberbullying, I hear kind of other professions mainly get scared of like bad reviews on Google. So I haven't really ever heard it described quite like that. I'm sure that's an issue in the veterinary profession too, but that's really fascinating. I don't think I've heard of, besides the dentist that went on those hunting trips, right? I don't think I've heard of any like death threat level stuff.
People love their pets so, so much. And pets are this innocent thing in our lives, right? And they are a source of unconditional love. And you get very strong, strong emotions from that, which is great. I mean, I feel the same, right? Like I've dedicated my whole life to helping animals. So I get where that like depth and well of emotion comes from. But yeah, speaking to other professionals, speaking to people who are MDs, and you would think an MD, like you're working on people. How is this not happening to you? Like MDs, dentists, lawyers, like nobody likes a bad Yelp review. Nobody does. We all have them. It's a thing. That's just part of the customer service, part of the job. This is the next level, though. And this is, you know, certainly thankfully less common than the occasional one-star Yelp review. But this is where people go to a level which is doesn't make any sense. And it's kind of this anger begets anger. The story gets presented in the most emotional way. And then all of a sudden, these veterinary professionals who are being, if anything, overly altruistic, right? They're like hurting themselves to help this dog, now are being hurt again and again and again by the public. You know, they'll go review bomb their site. So they'll go leave enough one-star reviews to bring it to zero. And then they'll phone bomb, they'll call the clinic until no other calls can get in. And then occasionally they'll pick it. And then, you know, unfortunately, threats of violence start. And so it really is scary. I mean, to the point where we all kind of have a procedure in mind to deal with it, which that's not something I learned in vet school.
But it's so wonderful that your group exists to be able to support a veterinarian in that kind of a situation, because if that person was alone, I mean, I can't imagine handling something like that alone.
Yeah, absolutely. And big shout out to one of our other board members, Dr. Abby Whiting, along with Dr. Caitlin DeWild, the social DVM, have put together a really great cyberbullying resource. So if you are in the middle of it and you just need like a quick printout PDF, like the checklist of what to do, like we have that for you. Like we're really trying to work on these problems that affect all too many of us.
That's great. So like a couple other things I want to cover. Access to medications. This is one of the things that like healthcare professionals in general, it's kind of like, you know, you have homes that own firearms have a higher suicide rate than homes that don't own them, because it's like you have the means that can very quickly end your life. And if you're a trained bazillion numbers of years of school and you have all the drugs and you know exactly how to put down an elephant.
There's not a veterinarian on the planet who doesn't know the dose of euthanasia solution to kill a mammal, right? Like that's just in your brain from like your third day of work on forward. And I think, you know, I think it's a complicated issue. Access to means, you know, if you look across, as you mentioned, like all people who are suicidal, having access to means puts you in a lot of danger. So be that a gun, be that whatever. And healthcare professionals are in particular danger, once, because we have such stressful jobs, as we've kind of covered, but also, too, because we have this access. And in fact, there was a recent study that was done by Dr. Whitty out of Auburn, who looked at veterinarian and veterinary technician suicides. If we actually take away access to euthanasia solution, her study suggests that we might actually reduce our suicide rate significantly enough to not be that different from the general public, which I think is a huge, huge thing. Now, that's for veterinarians and not veterinary technicians. And I think that's really started a conversation around limiting access to means. This is a controlled substance. It's something that should be locked up and is if you're doing your veterinary clinic right. But there are a lot of scenarios where, you know, the veterinarian is the only person there and they're getting it by themselves and things like that. And so we're trying to start a campaign where that drug is really not accessed unless two people are there. And there's a great veterinarian, Dr. Andy Rourke, who started a campaign called Four Eyes Save Lives. Basically saying in whatever way your clinic is able, really think about procedure around access to that medication. So nobody is there in the middle of the night after a really bad day in a low space with the key by themselves. You know, like how can we really get the scenario where this access is not so, so easy? Now, anytime across any suicide prevention plan, we talk about limiting access to means, there's actually pretty commonly some the critiques are always the same, like, well, they'll just go do it somewhere else. And actually, across multiple studies and multiple scenarios, we've shown that that's not really the case. I mean, certainly some people will, but if you look over the population, if you prevent someone from acting in an impulsive moment, it gives you time. It gives you time to deal with what's happening with them. And I think the other critique that we hear is like, locking up my euthanasia solution is not going to make me feel better. You're just making my life more complicated. And that's, I hear that. And I really do, because locking up access to means doesn't make you really feel better. It doesn't make any of the problems in your life go away. It doesn't make your student debt less. It doesn't make any of that go away. But what it does do is it gives us time to help you. And that's really what we're doing. We're getting you out of that impulsive moment, hopefully, so we can start to work on solutions with you. So it is a last-ditch safety catch measure, but it is one that is so, so important, because once that person enters into an active attempt, we're in a bad space. We don't have a lot of time to help them. So we want to keep them from getting there so we can hopefully help them and deal with all of these other problems that got them there to begin with.
I love that slogan, four eyes save lives. I think that's fantastic. I mean, like, so there's like this nuclear sub movie with like Denzel Washington, I think. And he has like the key, right, to the nuclear missiles. And you have to have both of the things in there. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, you don't have to wait for some sort of like federal regulation or state law, right? This is something that vets and people that love and know vets could support happening in every healthcare setting. It seems like this should be the case, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of laws around this, but I think also as individuals working in a practice, we can encourage our practice. It doesn't matter if you're the practice owner, it doesn't matter, but we can encourage process that keeps everybody safe. And there are absolutely some practice scenarios. There are ambulatory vets who are by themselves all day. There are scenarios where it doesn't work, but we can't throw out the solution because it doesn't work 100% of the time, right? Perfect is the enemy of good. And so this is like an actionable thing that all veterinary clinics can at least try to implement. Research has shown that it would have a really big impact on our suicide rate. So that seems worth doing, right?
It does seem like that. So what are some warning signs that a colleague is in distress? Is there anything that you can recognize?
So I would say in general, go with your gut. You work with these people. Often you'll have an inkling that something's happening. Certainly there are some behavioral triggers and some, you know, things that people say that should really absolutely cue you in that something bad is happening. I mean, if someone starts acting very, very differently, very depressed or very manic, very angry, big mood swings, anything like that, you know, it's always worth a check-in, right? Even if they're not suicidal, like something's up, let's just check in. And then certainly if somebody's saying things like, I can't do this anymore, I don't want to live like this anymore, anything that has kind of a finality to it. Certainly sometimes we all say that stuff kind of just hyperbolically, right? But especially if you work in a high-risk field like mine, if one of your colleagues, coworkers, or friends says that, it's time to check in, right? And so there's a really great training program called Question, Persuade, Refer, QPR. And if you go to the QPRinstitute.com, you can take a 30-45 minute training for about $30. It's free if you're an AVMA member, that teaches you how to have that conversation. Because we can all admit that's kind of a like a high level conversation, right? That's not a, hey, how you doing? Like, this is a conversation where we really sit down and we talk about what's happening with someone with the goal to help them. And I really want to impress on everyone, when you're dealing with a coworker or a friend who is suicidal, it is not your job to fix it. That is not your job. Particularly people who work in medicine, we feel like any problem that's put on our plate, we're fixers, we're doers. This is not what we're doing here. When we're doing a crisis intervention with someone, our job is to get them their immediate physical safety handled and then get them to resources. It's absolutely getting them to mental health care, therapist, social worker. We need to get them to those professionals who can help them deal with what's happening. And sometimes those professionals include financial planners, right? If you're so stressed out about your student loan, we absolutely at NAMVI, we have a grants program for veterinary professionals, and some of the things we've paid for are financial planners, because this affects a lot of us.
The one good news I have is some things are not curable, but student loans are 100% curable 100% of the time. It's not brain surgery. It's 100% cure rate if you're willing to follow the things you need to do. And that's true too. Like, even if you have 400, 500,000, so that's one reason I love my job, is getting to have 100% cure rate. It's pretty addicting.
Lives, Travis, you really are, honestly. And I'm not, I mean, I am, you know, shining you on a little bit, but also this is something that's been shown in research. There's a great study, I'll call them Merck Veterinary Wellbeing Study, and they actually showed having a financial planner increased veterinary wellbeing. You are less likely to be in serious distress, and you are more likely to have good wellbeing if you have a financial planner. So this is another actionable solution that's been proved independently.
The one kind of thought process I had with Student Loan Planner is, financial planning is kind of built for the top 2% of income earners with the fees that you need to charge because of compliance and rules and overhead, if you will. And so the thought process with us is by lowering the prices and figuring out a system where we can profitably serve people. You know, we can focus on volume, which means we're able to help more people. We can't help everybody because you can't necessarily find somebody who is quality to do a meeting for $20-$30, but it's been an exciting run so far. We'll see what happens. Maybe they'll forgive all the student loans and we won't have to do anything anymore.
Oh, that'd be so nice.
Yeah, I know. So a couple last few questions here. Well, what are some top resources that you have, maybe just for veterinarians and then for just professionals in general of getting help with their mental health?
Yeah, absolutely. So for veterinary professionals, be you a veterinarian, a veterinary staff member, a student, the Not One More Vet support groups and our charity in general are open to you. You can find out about us at nomv.org. We have great programs. We have a free month of therapy for all veterinary professionals through BetterHelp. I mentioned our grants program. We have educational programs. We're working on a lot of things. So we want to help you. If you are struggling and you work in my profession, I want to help you. My team wants to help you. So come check us out. Also, if you are a professional in any profession and are struggling or trying to think about how to help, we are happy to partner with any professional who wants to start a similar organization for their profession. Happy to. We're working with a group of lawyers right now. So this is something we've done before and we're happy to help you do it. It can be hugely impactful. And let me tell you, when I went to school to be a neurosurgeon, I didn't think that this is what I was going to do with my career, but it has been the single best thing I've ever done. And I would encourage you to think creatively about your own mental wellness. Put it on your calendar to take care of yourself. 1 hour a day of wellness care can make a huge impact in your day-to-day. And it sounds like a lot for a busy professional, 1 hour a day, but that's just 6% of your waking hours. Like, you can do it. You can find 6% of your life for yourself. And then find time for mental health care. And it can be challenging in a busy world to find time for it. And in the pandemic, it's hard to leave your house and go get it. But there are great online services like betterhelp.com where you can be paired with a licensed therapist or counselor who can help you online. And it's actually much cheaper than in-person therapy. And it can provide a bridge where you work 15-hour days and don't have breaks. Well, great. You can talk to your therapist afterwards.
What is the cost of that? And how do I make sure my boss doesn't find out?
It's protected by HIPAA. So you absolutely, if you're on BetterHelp or Talkspace, like, if you don't tell anybody, nobody's going to know. The cost is roughly equal to a single in-person session, the monthly cost. So I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's somewhere around like $175 to $200. And there's different options on like how much synchronous face-to-face contact you want that changes your levels a little bit. But, you know, generally you're looking at $175, $200 a month. And then the other thing that people don't think about that they probably already have as part of their benefits package is something called an EAP, an Employee Assistance Program. And this is usually just a phone number, a website you can go to that will help you with a variety of things. And once again, this is private. They're not going to tell your boss. They can help you find childcare and elder care and transportation if you're having trouble. Like, that's not just mental health care, which is great and important, but wellness is so much more than just mental health care. So a lot of those other things that bug us, like, I have to go to work right now, but my nanny has coronavirus. I hope not. But, you know, that's a reality. And like, how do I find childcare? Well, these EAP programs are something where if you reach out to them, they often have resources that you've never even heard of. So I strongly encourage people to use those. And they're often like, you know, the eighth page in your benefits package, long past you've stopped reading. Like, it's in there. Just go look for it.
So just ask your HR person, do you have an EAP program, right?
Yeah. And a lot of professions do. I'll say veterinarians, only about 17% of us do. And I hope that could increase. But
that'd be the big employers, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if somebody's a vet, they need to go to just type in NOMV, N-O-M-V on Facebook. Is that right?
Yep, absolutely. Or Not One More Vet on Facebook. And we've got a separate website, nomv.org, which has got links to all of our programs.
And what was it? BetterHelp?
BetterHelp.
H-E-L-P. Okay. And then if somebody was interested in reaching out to set up get some suggestions for setting up a organization for their profession, is there a way you'd feel comfortable sharing your contact info?
There's a contact us button on the nomv.org webpage, and you'll get connected to a board member or our brand new executive director.
That's great. And then and you don't have to be a vet to just press the contact button and be joined.
No, anybody can press it. Happy to talk to you.
Great. Dr. Carrie Journey, thank you so much for being on today's podcast. I can't thank you enough. And I imagine you've really helped a lot of people today.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me, Travis. And keep up the good work with student loans. We need people like you.
Well, until they're gone, right? Until they're forgiven.
We'll be happy to be out of work, right? When no dogs ever get sick and no one has student loans, you and I can have
so. That's a great way to end it. Thank you, Carrie.
Absolutely.